This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Cynthia Lyons, Naperville, Illinois. Don Quixote, Volume 1, by Miguel de Cervantes Saavedra, translated by John Ormsby. Part 5, Chapter 14 to 15. Chapter 14, wherein are inserted the despairing verses of the dead shepherd, together with other incidents not looked for. The Lay of Chrysostom. Since thou dost in thy cruelty desire the ruthless rigor of thy tyranny, from tongue to tongue, from land to land proclaimed, the very hell will I constrain to lend this stricken breast of mine deep notes of woe to serve my need of fitting utterance. And as I strive to body forth the tale of all I suffer, all that thou hast done, forth shall the dread voice roll and bear along shreds from my vitals torn for greater pain. Then listen, not to dulcet harmony, but to a discord wrung by mad despair out of this bosom's depths of bitterness, to ease my heart and plant a sting in thine. The lion's roar, the fierce wolf's savage howl, the horrid hissing of the scaly snake, the awesome cries of monsters yet unnamed, the crow's ill-boding croak, the hollow moan of wild winds wrestling with the restless sea, the wrathful bellow of the vanquished bull, the plaintive sobbing of the widowed dove, the envied owl's sad note, the wail of woe that rises from the dreary choir of hell, commingled in one sound, confusing sense. Let all these come to aid my soul's complaint, for pain like mine demands new modes of song. No echoes of that discord shall be heard where Father Tagus rolls, or on the banks of olive-bordered Betis to the rocks, or in deep caverns shall my plaint be told. And by a lifeless tongue in living words, or in dark valleys or on lonely shores, where neither foot of man nor sunbeam falls, or in among the poison-breathing swarms of monsters nourished by the sluggish Nile, for though it be to solitudes remote, the hoarse vague echoes of my sorrows sound thy matchless cruelty, my dismal fate shall carry them to all the spacious world. Disdain hath power to kill, and patience dies, slain by suspicion, be it false or true. And deadly is the force of jealousy. Long absence makes of life a dreary void. No hope or happiness can give repose to him that ever fears to be forgot, and death inevitable waits in hall. But I, by some strange miracle, live on, a prey to absence, jealousy, disdain, racked by suspicion as by certainty, forgotten, left to feed my flame alone. And while I suffer thus, there comes no ray of hope to gladden me athwart the gloom. Nor do I look for it in my despair, but rather clinging to a cureless woe, all hope do I abjure forevermore. Can there be hope where fear is? Were it well, when far more certain are the grounds of fear? Ought I to shut mine eyes to jealousy, if through a thousand heart wounds it appears? Who would not give free access to distrust, seeing disdain unveiled, and bitter change, all his suspicions turned to certainties, and the fair truth transformed into a lie? O thou fierce tyrant of the realms of love, O jealousy, put chains upon these hands and bind me with thy strongest cord, disdain. But woe is me, triumphant over all. My sufferings drown the memory of you. And now I die. And since there is no hope of happiness for me in life or death, still to my fantasy I'll fondly cling. I'll say that he is wise who loveth well, and that the soul most free is that most bound in thraldom to the ancient tyrant love. I'll say that she who is mine enemy in that fair body hath as fair a mind, and that her coldness is but my desert, and that by virtue of the pain he sends, love rules his kingdom with a gentle sway. Thus self-deluding and in bondage sore, and wearing out the wretched shred of life to which I am reduced by her disdain, I'll give this soul and body to the winds, all hopeless of a crown of bliss in store. Thou, whose injustice hath supplied the cause that makes me quit the weary life I loathe, as by this wounded bosom thou canst see how willingly thy victim I become, let not my death, if haply worth a tear, cloud the clear heaven that dwells in thy bright eyes. I would not have thee expiate in aught the crime of having made my heart thy prey, but rather let thy laughter gaily ring and prove my death to be thy festival. Fool that I am to bid thee, well I know thy glory gains by my untimely end. And now it is the time from hell's abyss, come thirsting Tantalus, come Sisyphus, heaving the cruel stone, come Tityus with vulture and with wheel Ixion come, and come the sisters of the ceaseless toil, and all into this breast transfer their pains. And if such tribute to despair be due, chant in their deepest tones a doleful dirge over a corse unworthy of a shroud. Let the three-headed guardian of the gate and all the monstrous progeny of hell the doleful concert join. A lover dead, methinks, can have no fitter obsequies. Lay of despair, grieve not when thou art gone forth from this sorrowing heart. My misery brings fortune to the cause that gave thee birth. Then banish sadness even in the tomb. The lay of Chrysostom met with the approbation of the listeners, though the reader said it did not seem to him to agree with what he had heard of Marcella's reserve and propriety, for Chrysostom complained in it of jealousy, suspicion, and absence, all to the prejudice of the good name and fame of Marcella, to which Ambrosio replied, as one who knew well his friend's most secret thoughts, Señor, to remove that doubt, I should tell you that when the unhappy man wrote this lay, he was away from Marcella, from whom he had voluntarily separated himself, to try if absence would act with him as it is wont, and as everything distresses and every fear haunts the banished lover, so imaginary jealousies and suspicions, dreaded as if they were true, tormented Chrysostom, and thus the truth of what report declares of the virtue of Marcella remains unshaken, and with her envy itself should not and cannot find any fault save that of being cruel, somewhat haughty, and very scornful. That is true, said Vivaldo, and as he was about to read another paper of those he had preserved from the fire, he was stopped by a marvelous vision, for such it seemed, that unexpectedly presented itself to their eyes, for on the summit of the rock where they were digging the grave there appeared the shepherdess Marcella, so beautiful that her beauty exceeded its reputation. Those who had never till then beheld her gazed upon her in wonder and silence, and those who were accustomed to see her were not less amazed than those who had never seen her before. But the instant Ambrosio saw her, he addressed her with manifest indignation. "Art thou come by chance, cruel basilisk of these mountains, to see if in thy presence blood will flow from the wounds of this wretched being thy cruelty has robbed of life? Or is it to exult over the cruel work of thy humors that thou art come? Or like another pitiless Nero, to look down from that height upon the ruin of his Rome in embers? Or in thy arrogance to trample on this ill-fated corpse, as the ungrateful daughter trampled on her father Tarquin's? Tell us quickly, for what thou art come, or what it is thou wouldst have, for, as I know the thoughts of Chrysostom never fail to obey thee in life, I will make all these who call themselves his friends obey thee, though he be dead." "I come not, Ambrosia, for any of the purposes thou hast named," replied Marcella, "but to defend myself and to prove how unreasonable are all those who blame me for their sorrow and for Chrysostom's death. And therefore I ask all of you that are here to give me your attention, for will not take much time or many words to bring the truth home to persons of sense. Heaven has made me, so you say, beautiful, and so much so that in spite of yourselves, my beauty leads you to love me. And for the love you show me, you say, and even urge, that I am bound to love you. By that natural understanding which God has given me, I know that everything beautiful attracts love, but I cannot see how, by reason of being loved, that which is loved for its beauty is bound to love that which loves it. Besides, it may happen that the lover of that which is beautiful may be ugly, and ugliness being detestable, it is very absurd to say, 'I love thee because thou art beautiful, thou must love me though I be ugly.' But supposing the beauty equal on both sides, it does not follow that the inclinations must be therefore alike, for it is not every beauty that excites love, some but pleasing the eye without winning the affection. And if every sort of beauty excited love and won the heart, the will would wander vaguely to and fro, unable to make choice of any. For as there is an infinity of beautiful objects, there must be an infinity of inclinations. And true love, I have heard it said, is indivisible and must be voluntary and not compelled. If this be so, as I believe it to be, why do you desire me to bend my will by force, for no other reason but that you say you love me? Nay, tell me, had heaven made me ugly, as it has made me beautiful, could I with justice complain of you for not loving me? Moreover, you must remember that the beauty I possess was no choice of mine, for, be it what it may, heaven of its bounty gave it me without my asking or choosing it. And as the viper, though it kills with it, does not deserve to be blamed for the poison it carries, as it is a gift of nature, neither do I deserve reproach for being beautiful. For beauty in a modest woman is like fire at a distance or a sharp sword. The one does not burn, the other does not cut. Those who do not come too near. Honor and virtue are the ornaments of the mind, without which the body, though it be so, has no right to pass for beautiful. But if modesty is one of the virtues that specially lend a grace and charm to mind and body, why should she who is loved for her beauty part with it to gratify one who for his pleasure alone strives with all his might and energy to rob her of it? I was born free, and that I might live in freedom, I chose the solitude of the fields. In the trees of the mountains I find society. The clear waters of the brooks are my mirrors, and to the trees and waters I make known my thoughts and charms. I am a fire afar off, a sword laid aside. Those whom I have inspired with love by letting them see me, I have by words undeceived, and if their longings live on hope, and I have given none to Chrysostom or to any other, it cannot justly be said that the death of any is my doing, for it was rather his own obstinacy than my cruelty that killed him. And if it be made a charge against me that his wishes were honorable, and that therefore I was bound to yield to them, I answer that, when on this very spot where now his grave is made, he declared to me his purity of purpose, I told him that mine was to live in perpetual solitude, and that the earth alone should enjoy the fruits of my retirement and the spoils of my beauty. And if, after this open avowal, he chose to persist against hope and steer against the wind, what wonder is it that he should sink in the depths of his infatuation? If I had encouraged him, I should be false. If I had gratified him, I should have acted against my own better resolution and purpose. He was persistent in spite of warning. He despaired without being hated. But think you now, if it be reasonable, that his suffering should be laid to my charge. Let him who has been deceived complain. Let him give way to despair, whose encouraged hopes have proved vain. Let him flatter himself, whom I shall entice. Let him boast, whom I shall receive. But let not him call me cruel or homicide, to whom I make no promise, upon whom I practice no deception, whom I neither entice nor receive. It has not been so far the will of heaven that I should love by fate, and to expect me to love by choice is idle. Let this general declaration serve for each of my suitors on his own account, and let it be understood from this time forth that if anyone dies for me, it is not of jealousy or misery he dies, for she who loves no one can give no cause for jealousy to any, and candor is not to be confounded with scorn. Let him who calls me wild beast and basilisk leave me alone as something noxious and evil. Let him who calls me ungrateful withhold his service. Who calls me wayward, seek not my acquaintance. Who calls me cruel, pursue me not. For this wild beast, this basilisk, this ungrateful, cruel, wayward being has no kind of desire to seek, serve, know, or follow them. If Chrysostom's impatience and violent passion killed him, why should my modest behavior and circumspection be blamed? If I preserve my purity in the society of the trees, why should he who would have me preserve it among men seek to rob me of it? I have, as you know, wealth of my own, and I covet not that of others. My taste is for freedom, and I have no relish for constraint. I neither love nor hate anyone. I do not deceive this one or court that, or trifle with one or play with another. The modest converse of the shepherd girls of these hamlets and the care of my goats are my recreations. My desires are bounded by these mountains, and if they ever wander hence, it is to contemplate the beauty of the heavens, steps by which the soul travels to its primeval abode. With these words, and not waiting to hear a reply, she turned and passed into the thickest part of a wood that was hard by, leaving all who were there lost in admiration as much of her good sense as of her beauty. Some, those wounded by the irresistible shafts launched by her bright eyes, made as though they would follow her, heedless of the frank declaration they had heard, seeing which, and deeming this a fitting occasion for the exercise of his chivalry in aid of distressed damsels, Don Quixote, laying his hand on the hilt of his sword, exclaimed in a loud and distinct voice, "Let no one, whatever his rank or condition, dare to follow the beautiful Marcella, under pain of incurring my fierce indignation. She has shown by clear and satisfactory arguments that little or no fault is to be found with her for the death of Chrysostom, and also how far she is from yielding to the wishes of any of her lovers, for which reason, instead of being followed and persecuted, she should in justice be honored and esteemed by all the good people of the world, for she shows that she is the only woman in it that holds to such a virtuous resolution." Whether it was because of the threats of Don Quixote, or because Ambrosio told them to fulfill their duty to their good friend, none of the shepherds moved or stirred from the spot until, having finished the grave and burned Chrysostom's papers, they laid his body in it, not without many tears from those who stood by. They closed the grave with a heavy stone until a slab was ready, which Ambrosio said he meant to have prepared, with an epitaph which was to be to this effect: "Beneath the stone before your eyes, the body of a lover lies. In life he was a shepherd swain, in death a victim to disdain. Ungrateful, cruel, coy, and fair, was she that drove him to despair, and love hath made her his ally, for spreading wide his tyranny." They then strewed upon the grave a profusion of flowers and branches, and all expressing their condolence with his friend Ambrosio, took their Vivaldo, and his companion did the same. And Don Quixote bade farewell to his hosts and to the travelers, who pressed him to come with them to Seville, as being such a convenient place for finding adventures, for they presented themselves in every street and round every corner oftener than anywhere else. Don Quixote thanked them for their advice and for the disposition they showed to do him a favor, and said that for the present he would not and must not go to Seville until he had cleared all these mountains of highwaymen and robbers, of whom report said they were full. Seeing his good intention, the travelers were unwilling to press him further, and once more bidding him farewell, they left him and pursued their journey, in the course of which they did not fail to discuss the story of Marcella and Chrysostom, as well as the madness of Don Quixote. He, on his part, resolved to go in quest of the shepherdess Marcella, and make offer to her of all the service he could render her. But things did not fall out with him as he expected, according to what is related in the course of this veracious history, of which the second part ends here. Chapter 15, in which is related the unfortunate adventure that Don Quixote fell in with when he fell out with certain heartless Yanguesans. the sage Sidi Hamete Benengele relates that as soon as Don Quixote took leave of his hosts and all who had been present at the burial of Chrysostom, he and his squire passed into the same wood which they had seen the shepherdess Marcella enter, and after having wandered for more than 2 hours in all directions in search of her without finding her, they came to a halt in a glade covered with tender grass, besides which ran a pleasant cool stream that invited and compelled them to pass there the hours of the noontide heat, which by this time was beginning to come on oppressively. Don Quixote and Sancho dismounted, and turning Rocinante and the ass loose to feed on the grass that there was there in abundance, they ransacked the alforjas, and without any ceremony, very peacefully and sociably, master and man made their repast on what they found in them. Sancho had not thought it worthwhile to hobble Rocinante, feeling sure, from what he knew of his staidness and freedom from incontinence, that all the mares in the Cordova pastures would not lead him into an impropriety. Chance, however, and the devil, who is not always asleep, so ordained it that feeding in this valley, there was a drove of Galician ponies belonging to certain young Guazin carriers, whose way it is to take their midday rest with their teams in places and spots where grass and water abound, and that where Don Quixote chanced to be, suited the young Guazin's purpose very well. It so happened, then, that Rocinante took a fancy to disport himself with their ladyships, the ponies, and abandoning his usual gait and demeanor as he scented them, he, without asking leave of his master, got up a briskish little trot and hastened to make known his wishes to them. They, however, it seemed, preferred their pasture to him, and received him with their heels and teeth to such effect that they soon broke his girths and left him naked without a saddle to cover him. But what must have been worse to him was that the carriers, seeing the violence he was offering to their mares, came running up armed with stakes, and so belabored him that they brought him sorely battered to the ground. By this time, Don Quixote and Sancho, who had witnessed the drubbing of Rocinante, came up panting, and said Don Quixote to Sancho, "As far as I can see, friend Sancho, these are not knights, but base folk of low birth. I mention it because thou canst lawfully aid me in taking due vengeance for the insult offered to Rocinante before our eyes." "What the devil vengeance can we take," answered Sancho, "if they are more than 20, and we no more than 2, or indeed, perhaps, not more than 1.5? "I count for 100, replied Don Quixote, and without more words he drew his sword and attacked the Anguazans, and excited and impelled by the example of his master, Sancho did the same. And to begin with, Don Quixote delivered a slash at one of them that laid open the leather jerkin he wore, together with a great portion of his shoulder. The Anguazans, seeing themselves assaulted by only 2 men, while they were so many, betook themselves to their stakes, and driving the 2 into the middle, they began to lay on with great zeal and energy. In fact, at the second blow they brought Sancho to the ground, and Don Quixote fared the same way, all his skill and high mettle availing him nothing, and fate willed it that he should fall at the feet of Rocinante, who had not yet risen, whereby it may seem how furiously stakes can pound in angry, boorish hands. Then, seeing the mischief they had done, the Anguissans, with all the haste they could, loaded their team and pursued their journey, leaving the two adventurers a sorry sight and in sorrier mood. Sancho was the first to come to, and finding himself close to his master, he called to him in a weak and doleful voice, "Señor Don Quixote, ah, Señor Don Quixote!" "What wouldst thou, brother Sancho?" answered Don Quixote in the same feeble, suffering tone as Sancho. "I would like, if it were possible," answered Sancho Panza, "your worship, to give me a couple of sups of that potion of the fiery blast, if it be that you have any to hand there. Perhaps it will serve for broken bones as well as for wounds." "If I only had it here, wretch that I am, what more should we want?" said Don Quixote. "But I swear to thee, Sancho Panza, on the faith of a knight-errant, ere 2 days are over, unless fortune orders otherwise, I mean to have it in my possession, or my hand will have lost its cunning." "But in how many does your worship think we shall have the use of our feet?" answered Sancho Panza. "For myself, I must say I cannot guess how many," said the battered knight Don Quixote, "but I take all the blame upon myself, for I had no business to put hand to sword against men who were not dubbed knights like myself. And so I believe that in punishment for having transgressed the laws of chivalry, the God of battles has permitted this chastisement to be administered to me. For which reason, brother Sancho, it is well thou shouldst receive a hint on the matter which I am now about to mention to thee, for it is of much importance to the welfare of both of us. It is when thou shalt see rabble of this sort offering us insult, thou art not to wait till I draw sword against them, for I shall not do so at all. But do thou draw sword and chastise them to thy heart's content, and if any knights come to their aid and defense, I will take care to defend thee and assail them with all my might. And thou hast already seen by a thousand signs and proofs what the might of this strong arm of mine is equal to." So uplifted had the poor gentleman become through the victory over the stout Biscayan. But Sancho did not so fully approve of his master's admonition as to let it pass without saying in reply, "Señor, I am a man of peace, meek and quiet, and I can put up with any affront, because I have a wife of children to support and bring up. So let it be likewise a hint to your worship, as it cannot be a mandate, that on no account will I draw sword either against clown or against knight, and that here before God I forgive the insults that have been offered me, whether they have been, are, or shall be offered me by high or low, rich or poor, noble or commoner, not accepting any rank or condition whatsoever." To all which his master said in reply, "I wish I had breath enough to speak somewhat easily, and that the pain I feel on this side would abate so as to let me explain to thee, Panza, the mistake thou makest. Come now, sinner, suppose the winds of fortune, hitherto so adverse, should turn in our favor, filling the sails of our desires so that safely and without impediment we put into port in some one of those islands I have promised thee. How would it be with thee if on winning it I made thee lord of it? Why, thou wilt make it well nigh impossible, through not being a knight, nor having any desire to be one, nor possessing the courage, nor the will to avenge insults, or defend thy lordship. For thou must know that in newly conquered kingdoms and provinces, the minds of the inhabitants are never so quiet, nor so well disposed to the new lord, that there is no fear of their making some move to change matters once more, and try, as they say, what chance may do for them. So it is essential that the new possessor should have good sense to enable him to govern, and valor to attack and defend himself, whatever may befall him. In what has now befallen us, answered Sancho, I'd have been well pleased to have that good sense and that valor your worship speaks of. But I swear on the faith of a poor man, I am more fit for plasters than for arguments. See if your worship can get up, and let us help Rosinante, though he does not deserve it, for he was the main cause of all this thrashing. I never thought it of Rosinante, for I took him to be a virtuous person and as quiet as myself. After all, they say right that it takes a long time to come to know people, and that there is nothing sure in this life. Who would have said it after such mighty slashes as your worship gave that unlucky knight-errant? There was coming traveling post, and at the very heels of them such a great storm of sticks as has fallen upon our shoulders. And yet thine, Sancho, replied Don Quixote, ought to be used to such squalls, but mine, reared in soft cloth and fine linen, it is plain they must feel more keenly the pain of this mishap. And if it were not that I imagine, why do I say imagine, know of a certainty that all these annoyances are very necessary accompaniments of the calling of arms, I would lay me down here to die of pure vexation. To this the squire replied, Señor, as these mishaps are what one reaps of chivalry, tell me if they happen very often, or if they have their own fixed time for coming to pass, because it seems to me that after two harvests we shall be no good for the third, unless God in his infinite mercy helps us. No, friend Sancho, answered Don Quixote, that the life of knight-errant is subject to a thousand dangers and reverses, and neither more nor less is it within immediate possibility for knights-errant to become kings and emperors, as experience has shown in the case of many different knights with whose histories I am thoroughly acquainted. And I could tell thee now, if the pain would let me, of some who simply by might of arm have risen to the high stations I have mentioned, and those same, both before and after, experienced diverse misfortunes and miseries. For the valiant Amadis of Gaul found himself in the power of his mortal enemy Archelaus, the magician, who, it is positively asserted, holding him captive, gave him more than 200 lashes with the reins of his horse while tied to one of the pillars of a court. And moreover, there is a certain recondite author of no small authority who says that the knight of Phoebus, being caught in a certain pitfall which opened under his feet in a certain castle, on falling found himself bound hand and foot in a deep pit underground, where they administered to him one of those things they call clysters of sand and snow water, that well nigh finished him, and if he had not been succored in that sore extremity by a sage, a great friend of his, it would have gone very hard with the poor knight. So I may well suffer in company with such worthy folk, for greater were the indignities which they had to suffer than those which we suffer. For I would have thee know, Sancho, that wounds caused by any instruments which happen by chance to be in hand inflict no indignity. And this is laid down in the law of the duel in express words. If, for instance, the cobbler strikes another with the last which he has in his hand, though it be in fact a piece of wood, it cannot be said for that reason that he whom he struck with it has been cudgeled. I say this lest thou shouldst imagine that because we have been drubbed in this affray, we have therefore suffered any indignity. For the arms those men carried, with which they pounded us, were nothing more than their stakes, and not one of them, so far as I remember, carried rapier, sword, or dagger. They gave me no time to see that much, answered Sancho, for hardly had I laid hand on my tizona when they signed the cross on my shoulders with their sticks in such style that they took the sight out of my eyes and the strength out of my feet, stretching me where I now lie, and where thinking of whether all those stake strokes were an indignity or not gives me no uneasiness, which the pain of the blow does, for they will remain as deeply impressed on my memory as on my shoulders. For all that, let me tell thee, Brother Panza, said Don Quixote, that there is no recollection which time does not put an end to, and no pain which death does not remove. And what greater misfortune can there be, replied Panza, than the one that waits for time to put an end to it and death remove it? If our mishap were not one of those that are cured with a couple of plasters, it would not be so bad. But I am beginning to think that all the plasters in a hospital almost won't be enough to put us right. No more of that. Plunk strength out of weakness, Sancho, as I mean to do, returned Don Quixote. And let us see how Rosinante is, for it seems to me that not the least share of this mishap has fallen to the lot of the poor beast. There is nothing wonderful in that, replied Sancho, since he is a knight-errant too. What I wonder at is that my beast should have come off scot-free where we came out scotched. Fortune always leaves a door open in adversity in order to bring relief to it, said Don Quixote. I say so because this little beast may now supply the want of Rosinante, carrying me hence to some castle where I may be cured of my wounds. And moreover, I shall not hold it any dishonor to be so mounted, for I remember having read how the good old Silenus, the tutor and instructor of the gay god of laughter, when he entered the city of the Hundred Gates, went very contentedly mounted on a handsome ass. It may be true that he went mounted, as your worship says, answered Sancho, but there is a great difference between going mounted and going slung like a sack of manure. To which Don Quixote replied, wounds received in battle confer honor instead of taking it away. And so, friend Panza, say no more, but, as I told thee before, get up as well as thou canst, and put me on top of thy beast in whatever fashion pleases thee best, and let us go hence ere night comes on and surprise us in these wilds. And yet I have heard your worship say, observed Panza, that it is very meet for knights errant to sleep in wastes and deserts, and that they esteem it very good fortune. That is, said Don Quixote, when they cannot help it, or when they are in love. And so true is this, that there have been knights who have remained 2 years on rocks in sunshine and shade and all the inclemencies of heaven, without their ladies knowing anything of it. And one of these was Amadis, when, under the name of Beltenebros, he took up his abode on the Penipobra, for I know not if it was 8 years or 8 months, for I am not very sure of the reckoning. At any rate, he stayed there doing penance, for I know not what pique the Princess Oriana had against him. But no more of this now, Sancho, and make haste before a mishap like Rocinante's befalls the ass. The very devil would be in it in that case, said Sancho, and letting off 30 oaths and 60 sighs and 120 maledictions and execrations on whomsoever it was that had brought him there, he raised himself, stopping halfway bent like a Turkish bow without power to bring himself upright. But with all his pains he saddled his ass, who too had gone astray somewhat, yielding to the excessive license of the day. He next raised up Rocinante, and as for him, had he possessed a tongue to complain with, most assuredly neither Sancho nor his master would have been behind him. To be brief, Sancho fixed Don Quixote on the ass and secured Rocinante with a leading rein, and taking the ass by the halter, he proceeded more or less in the direction in which it seemed to him the high road might be. And as chance was conducting their affairs for them from good to better, he had not gone a short league when the road came in sight, and on it he perceived an inn, which to his annoyance and to the delight of Don Quixote must needs be a castle. Sancho insisted that it was an inn, and his master that it was not one, but a castle, and the dispute lasted so long that before the point was settled they had time to reach it, and into it Sancho entered with all his team without any further controversy. End of chapter 15.